Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this week are comedian Brendan O'Carroll and his actress wife Jenny Gibney. Brendan is also an accomplished writer, producer, actor, director, and he recently won a BAFTA for his hit TV series Mrs. Brown's Boys, in which he portrays the foul-mouthed matriarch. And Jenny stars as his daughter in the series and, of course, as his partner in real life. You're both really welcome. You were laughing already before you even started.
Yeah. Great to be here, Miriam. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having us. It's one of the things that I think keeps us going. We've both been on this roller coaster together, up and down, but the one thing that we've always been able to do is laugh. We've always made each other laugh. Yeah.
Do you laugh a lot together?
Oh, yeah.
God, yeah.
That's
I find her hilarious. No, the things I find hilarious, she doesn't necessarily want me to laugh at.
She's the worst
sense of direction in the entire
world. I have no
world.
Sense of direction.
Oh, no, I have the worst sense of direction. Have you a bad sense of direction?
Really bad.
I'm not talking about not being able to find a way around the city. I'm talking about...
I'll ask Brendan for directions to go somewhere and he'll say, well, you know, when you get on such and such a road, I'm going, no, Brendan, I'm still in the driveway. Do I go left or right?
I swear to God. She only knows her way to a lot of places in Dublin
from
my ma's.
So before I drive to my ma's.
She drives to her ma's and starts there.
Where is your ma live?
Ballymun Avenue.
Glasnevin Avenue. Now they changed the name years ago.
I grew up in Ballymun Avenue, so there you go.
And ironically, when my mum was a TD, she bought a house, which is our first house purchase, which she sold, and then I'll get into that later. But for 3 years, I lived on Ballymun Avenue.
You were destined to meet.
Absolutely.
I think we go through all the close calls. Yeah. I think a week before I had my first wedding, Jenny made a confirmation in the same church.
So
his
story about it is, you know, the tradition, the Dublin tradition of the grushy at the wedding,
where the best man throws out a whole load of coins when he comes out of church.
Heard of it.
He reckons I was in the bushes when they threw the grushy at his wedding and everybody ran for the money and I stood in the background going, take it, I'll be back.
I have a plan.
Where did you both meet in the end?
In a black corridor in the dark, where she told me to F off and sit down. That's the first time we met.
Let me explain.
Yeah, do, please, because I still don't understand.
He came to see me in a play I was in.
He didn't come to see me.
I came to see a play that I was also in. Is that better?
And so you were acting, Jenny.
I was acting in the play, but I had to make my entrance from the theatre up the steps onto the stage. So I was hiding, concealed in the entrance.
Now, let me take it. I went to see the play particularly because I wanted a director. I was looking at the director to direct something that I'd written. And I wanted to see his work. So I thought, to see if he's the same, because comedy is about rhythms. And, you know, you wouldn't get a pop director to direct a rap video or a rap director to direct Dean Martin. So I wanted to see if his rhythm was the same as my rhythm. So he had an opening night. And he said, why don't you come along to the opening night? I said, I'd love to. I'm in London that day. I get back from London. My flight is delayed. I have a driver waiting for me, but we're now a half an hour behind time and I'm looking at my watch and I'm not going to get to this theatre till about 8:10 and the curtain's up at 8. So I rang the theatre just to say, please don't give away my ticket. I am coming. So I rang and I said, look, I said, Brendan O'Carroll, I'm on my way. I said, oh, no, the director's told us to hold the curtain till you get here. So now I feel even worse. I feel more pressure. So we're belting through town. I get into the box office and you know what you do? I'm so sorry. Thanks very much. I'm really sorry. I'm terribly sorry. I got delayed. And they don't care. But you're still feeling... we're Irish. When you feel the need to apologise, I'm so sorry. Thank you very much. Thank you. Where do we... And that door there. I said, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm so sorry. I went in the door and there's an usherette standing inside the door. So I showed him a ticket and I said, I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry. She said, oh, just F off and sit down. I thought, well, that's no attitude for staff to take. Usherette shouldn't be like that. Went in and sat down and the lights went down. The house lights went down and
from the time he was at the airport where he got the phone call to say it's okay, we'll hold the curtain, I'm standing by to go on stage. Nobody thought to tell me we're holding the curtain. I'm 20 minutes standing in the dark
and it's opening night.
What's happening? Terrified, absolutely terrified. And then said, where will I sit? I don't care where you sit.
Where will I sit?
Somebody tell me what's happening. Has the play started? Have I missed my own first scene? No idea what was going on. So
she, at the end of the play, I went, no, the director, we had a different sense of comedy. But he had two actors, the barman and the barmaid. And Jenny was the barmaid. I'll have them. As soon as this show is finished, I'll have them. They're cracking actors. And then, you know the way, I was sure about the barman. I was sure about him. Brendan Morrissey, great actor, just a cracking actor. I was sure about him. I wasn't sure about the barmaid. I'd go back and I'll have a look again.
I wasn't sure.
No, but you know what I mean. I'd go back and I'd look again.
She's so giving you a dirty look there.
All the time. All my life. So I went back to look at the show again on a Tuesday night, and I watched the show, and it was really, the show was good. And then when the actors came out to take their bow, as they do, when she came out, she got a standing ovation. And I went, I'm absolutely right, she's bang on.
What he didn't know much later was, at the time, I was very lucky because I was able to temp in the bank when I wasn't, you know, working. And I was still temping in Bank of Ireland and Ormond Quay. And that night, everybody from the porter to the manager had come to see me in the show. And they all came. So as soon as I walked out, the whole 20 out of them stood up. And he went, and everybody else stood up because they stood up. But he thought I had got the whole audience to their feet. So
she joined us on the 9th of September 1995. And within 2 days of rehearsal, I thought I'd made a huge mistake.
And I thought he was the most arrogant person I'd ever met in my life. I thought, oh really, who is this person?
She was just so serious.
You have to take it serious. And we would have a rehearsal for 9:30 in the morning in Diggs Lane. I live in Ballymun Avenue.
Coffee is part of
doing,
rehearsal.
I was doing, still doing the show at night while I was rehearsing during the day. So I'd get into Diggs Lane for 9:30 in the morning, haven't been on stage the night before.
Poor you.
And at 11:45, we're still having coffee, talking about stories from the road. And I'm going, seriously, I don't want to hear another story. Can we start rehearsing?
That was called bonding and team building.
But if you didn't want to start the rehearsal till 12 o'clock, then call me for 11:30 and I get another 2 hours in bed.
Then you would miss my exciting stories about on the road.
Of course.
And the conversation that would ensue.
But at what stage did you fall for each other?
That was a slow process. That was
very slow process.
I remember the first time I liked her. I remember the first time I actually liked her. I didn't think she was obnoxious. We were touring with the play, that particular play. We were touring with that play, and God, so long ago, because I remember breakfast, and you could sit and have a fag in the restaurant over your
those
breakfast.
Those were the days.
So I used to come in the mornings, and I'd see her, come down to the hotel breakfast room, and I'd see her sitting over, reading the paper or whatever, and I just, hi, and I'd go over to the other side of the restaurant.
And I'd be sitting there going, please don't sit here, please don't sit here.
And I didn't. So, and that went on for weeks. And we were in one particular hotel, I can't remember where it was. And I would come down for breakfast late. And I was sitting having breakfast. Gave her a nod, morning. Gave her a nod, sitting having breakfast. And I looked over at her and I saw she had the Irish Times. And she had to fold it down to the quarter. Now, people that fold the Irish Times down to the quarter are doing the crossword. That's where you fold the Irish Times to the quarter. So I'm trying to see which quarter she's doing. Is she doing the Crossair? Is she doing?
You thought I was doing the simplex.
I thought you were doing the simplex. So I took me coffee and I was going back up to my room with my coffee. And just as I passed her, I said, I see you doing crossword. She said, oh yeah. I said, are you doing the simplex or Crossair? And she said, I'm not doing the Crossair. Oh, I said, right. How you doing? So she said, I'm doing okay. She said, if I can get 15 or 20 a day, I'm happy, you know, because Crossair is difficult. I said, yeah, you know, I said, you know, it takes time to get into his head. You need to get into his head.
I love this, the way you think you knew how it worked. You said the same. You said that I'd try and get it out as well. That, you know, it is.
I've been doing the Irish Times crossword since I was 9.
But you never finished it.
I did.
No, you didn't finish it.
The point of it being that I said, see that clue, for instance, and I went through and I picked one clue and I broke it down. All right, okay. So we sat down and we finished the crossword.
Together.
I sat down beside him and finished crossword. So the next day.
Is he good at them?
Very good.
Yeah. So the next day I came down.
I'm pretty good at them myself. But.
Yeah. And you're getting better. You're listening.
Thank you, kind sir.
Next morning I came down and where I sat that previous morning, and I've been sitting there every morning. We're creatures of habit. You go into a restaurant in a hotel, you're staying there a week. Wherever you sit that first morning, you tend to sit there every day. So I came over to where I sat with my coffee and there was a photocopy of today's Irish Times crossword. She left a photocopy there and she wasn't there. I don't know why you weren't there, but she'd gone early and she left a photocopy of it. So I scribbled through it and then we start doing it just not backstage but side stage or between scenes.
But it's interesting that crosswords brought you together. Love stories begin with
crosswords. Oh God, definitely did.
Well,
yeah.
I don't even know that, but that was a respect story. And I'll tell you what I did do. After that, I kind of looked at her a bit closer in her work and thinking, God, she's good. And then it was just, it was a gradual friendship then. It was, I tell you what it was about that first morning of that crossword as well. She smoked consulate. She was drinking black coffee. And the last person I sat that smoked concert, drank my coffee and did a crossword puzzle was my mother. And I suppose at the end of the day, you know, maybe Dr. Freud was right. At the end of the day, we all want to marry our mother. And maybe that's what
really
I did.
That's really interesting.
Maybe I did.
He didn't tell me that for years. We were working so closely.
Yeah.
And we were working for long periods. And then it was the first time we had a long period away from each other. You're kind of going, I actually miss him more than I actually thought I would miss him. You know, kind of miss, you know, the just each other's company.
It wasn't a moment. It was a kind of creep. It crept up on you. And it was kind of like
despite
that.
Our best efforts.
Despite our best efforts.
And did you get married in Florida?
Yeah.
Was that good?
Yeah, oh, it was pretty cool. It was cool. We invited our friends out and we said, look, come on out for a 2-week holiday.
We didn't want it to be a fuss. We wanted it to be a family fun occasion with our friends and family, but we didn't want a fuss.
No.
So
and didn't want to make a big deal of it. But at the end of the day, you know, you said to realize, it is a big deal. Getting married is a big deal.
So we brought everybody came out for 2 weeks.
And we told them on one of the days we're going to get married.
We're going to get married one of the days we're there. So that's it. And everybody brought their kids because we love having kids around. So
it was a great time. We always said we'd never get married. Because both of us had been married before and we felt that we trapped our own partners in a situation where they couldn't say if they were happy or unhappy. And we said, you know, I'd never do that. I wouldn't do that to Jenny. And she said, I wouldn't do it to you. And there's also, you talk yourself into this thing of thinking that it's the fact that we can both walk out that door any moment that is keeping us together. Because we kill each other. We used to fight like, oh, God.
We go to war.
We used to go to war. With rails.
Do you fight now?
No, not really. We spat.
It's fast.
But it just, you know.
You don't look like you fight. Actually.
And it doesn't matter. But we're too old. You know what you. It's life's too short.
We spat with each other, but it's kind of.
I could keep it up for two weeks now.
Most people
have. Could you walk for 2 weeks?
I could keep it up for 2 weeks. I could keep, you know. No, I'm not. No, forget it.
Don't like sulking.
I have no idea. I know. I'm too old for it now, but I could.
Most people have an argument, and then 2 days later, they're kind of. We really wish that argument hadn't happened or whatever. No, he gets entrenched. He is now. Going to
I'm
be
so good
stubborn.
At it. I'm really good at sulking. Very good.
Have you got better?
Much better.
I don't have time.
We kind of don't like the times where we're not.
I say
to
you're
each
a
other,
bitch. You're. So, she says you're. Yeah.
So
right.
We shout
okay.
At
now
each
let's
other
move
and
on.
Then it's
let's
gone.
Go. Get on with the next thing. Move on.
Because, as you say, you thought about it because you'd both been married before and you weren't going to get married, and then you did marry. Is it different? Is it more special in a way because you've made a big choice?
Certainly, the approach to it was. We were both very young when we got married our first time. You know, I was in my early 20s and James was 19. As were our partners. We're very young. And I remember being scared in my first marriage, walking down the aisle thinking, oh God, maybe I should stop this. I don't know how to stop. It kind of took a momentum of its own and I'm not sure, and I genuinely wasn't sure. Not to do with anything to do with my partner and like that, or but just what am I doing? You should know what you're doing. That was different. That was definitely different. And we
made an agreement
right up to
because we both had been married before, and we said, look, you know, this is a big step. So right up, we got married at the top of the steps overlooking the 18th green in our local golf course, and we said. Right up to the moment we get to the top of those steps, if you think for one second,
no, we said that as soon as the officiator said, "Do you?" I said,
"Right up
if
to that
I
moment.
Have the slightest doubt, I'm going to go. I don't know."
And we were really
not know,
calm
but
about
I don't
it,
know.
Saying, "Now we're not going to fall out. We'll just all our friends are there, and we'll say
we don't know." And
we
just turn around and say, "Listen, we're still going to have a party. We're still going to
have a
party,
but we're not kind of sure
because we're too old to be and nothing." Felt more right to me. As soon as they said, "Would do you?"
We were like two kids.
And I turned around and I looked down and everybody I loved was sitting there.
And all crying.
Yeah, Rory standing there crying, tears running down his face.
And it was lovely because my mum was my bridesmaid. But he just had our best friend.
My best friend was my best man, and how he became my best friend, how we became friends, was that when I was making Sparrow, he read in the newspaper that I'd run out of money and that the production might have to close down. He didn't know me. He didn't know who I was. But he knew I was a Troyer, he said. And he liked Troyers, and he sent me 50,000.
My lord!
Yeah,
Never knew me, never met me. He sent me 50,000.
He's such a good guy.
What's his name?
Mike Nolan in Cork, QEF Fasteners, and he is just.
So he was our best man,
and I didn't meet him for about a year after he gave it to me. I didn't meet him for about a year after that, and I bumped into him in an airport, and he was with somebody who told me. That's the guy who gave me the 50 grand. I said, listen, I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And then it turned out he played League of Ireland Soccer. I played League of Ireland Soccer. We kind of knew people we both knew. And it just grew and grew. And I just thought, you know what? you don't find really good, decent people too often in your life. And he is one of them.
Is,
and he's become
one of the good guys.
So he was my best man. And we're...
But that's our, that was our wedding party. Was
that's
our
nice
best friend?
Was your best
and
man? Yeah. And your mother
and
was
my
your
mom. Bride. And she loved it. She was fabulous.
It was listen. It was magic. Oh, don't get me wrong. Your first wedding is tremendous. And those people who are planning their marriage, it's the best. It's one of the best days of your life. It's absolutely fantastic. But just this second time around, I don't know. It was being conscious of what you were doing. It was being aware of what you were doing.
You're not conscious of it when you're that young. It's, and you get caught up in the roller coaster of planning the wedding and everything.
When you're younger, it becomes more about the wedding than the marriage.
So.
Than the marriage. And no matter what anybody would have told me then, I was getting married.
And I was the same. There was nobody would
when
have
I was
told
that young,
different.
I knew it all. I was 19. Leave me alone. You know, 20. Leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. There you go.
But the nice thing, you got married in Florida. And do you live in Florida now?
Yeah.
And what's that like?
It's paradise.
It's magic. Disney was built for me.
And our four grandkids, their first visit to Mickey Mouse, we were with them. Just, that was just magical. And they all love Mickey Mouse.
Which brings us to our first piece of music, which is the one that reminds you both when you get to Florida, you love playing it.
I have it on my iPod. And as soon as we get into the car, we look at each other, we drive out of the car park, and as soon, because there's no ground car park, as soon as you drive out of the car park, bang, that heat hits you. And I look at Jen and she looks at me and I just press the button and this is what plays.
That's Mr. Blue Sky from ELO, a song you both love because it associates you living now in Florida.
Yeah.
It's a long way from Florida, of course. You both, where did you grow up again, Jenny? Ballymun?
Ballymun Avenue, yeah.
And what was your background? Working class?
Working to middle class, I'd say. It was.
Dad was a fireman.
My dad was a fireman. My mum's a housewife and reared all of us. And we had a great background, Mary. We had a fantastic childhood. Absolutely surrounded by the love of two amazing parents who I'm extremely lucky at this age of my life to still have in my life. And I had one brother and three sisters. And I'm really close to my sisters and my brother.
They all ring each other every day.
I couldn't have written a better childhood for myself. It was absolutely amazing.
And you, Brendan, were you one of 11?
Yeah, I was
the youngest of 11.
And a late arrival. So we kind of were three families, you know, the older five, the middle five, and then me. She was 46 when I was born. She was sitting in Dáil Éireann. I was born to a sitting TD. And oftentimes I misunderstood some of the disputes between my mother and the older family. I misunderstood them because they didn't know the woman I knew, and I certainly didn't know the woman they knew. They were kids who were listening to their mother on the radio decrying the fact that so many kids were coming out of school illiterate and yet wouldn't be there to help them with their homework. So they couldn't reconcile those two. In my case, I was born at a very early age. My dad died. My mum retired from politics, except on the peripherals, but she started from full-time politics. And all of a sudden, they'd grown up and emigrated or married or whatever, because there's such an age difference between us. Now I had the undivided attention of this genius of a woman who before school every day would pinch me in the cheek as she told me shoelaces, and she pinched me in the cheek and she'd say to me, "You can be anything you want to be." And I grew up with this unshakable confidence where she wasn't even there to tie their shoelaces.
So are they jealous of you?
I don't know if it's jealous. I think
of the love that you got from your mother.
No, I don't think it was that. I think they would just resent that they didn't have a mother. You know, my dad was the mother at that stage. My dad was very much, he was a carpenter, and he was very much a 9-to-5, minimalist, did what he had to do, came home. At the end, he'd come home, have his tea. When he finished his tea, we were bathed three at a time on different nights. He was bathed, he'd run the bath, and then I'll be put to bed, and then he'd polish all the shoes, and he'd line them all up at the end of the stairs, and you get shoes with a towel on top of your shoes for your wash, and then you had your time. Whatever way your shoes came, that's the order in which you went into the bathroom, because we only had one bathroom. He was very organised. Where my mother was out trying to renegotiate trade pacts with Belgium and trying to get...
For people who don't know about your mother, in a few sentences, say what she did in terms of career. She was incredibly impressive for her time. She was in the Labour Party.
Yeah. She started off as a nun. Renounced her vows, married my dad because apparently he was a particularly good dancer and she loved dancing. Before she married my dad, when she renounced her vows, she went to teach and she taught languages in secondary school. Then she married my dad and was furred because I know young kids wouldn't even grasp the concept of it now, but a married woman could not work in the civil service in those days. So she said, I'm not having that. So she went into, got involved in the union, campaigning just particularly against that, and managed to get a change, but found that she had a panache for it and liked it. So she got into politics. She wanted to change a lot of laws. She wanted to change particularly anti-woman laws. And I often quote this one because it's just so outrageous. A law that she, one of the laws she repealed, got repealed, was a law that you could beat your wife provided you didn't use a stick longer than your forearm or thicker than your thumb. But she got some really good adoption and child protection, etc. laws. Anti-women laws.
So much changed, and it just frustrates me that we didn't learn about her in schools. How can somebody who was, so important
the first
at
woman.
The time?
But
she got the word, such an offensive word, bastard, taken off children's birth certificates.
Yeah, but then they replaced it.
With illegitimate.
With illegitimate, which was the same thing. Because, and again, younger people wouldn't understand. But in my day, when you went for a job, you had your cards from the Labour, your stamps, and your birth cert. That's what you gave in when you went for an application for a job. And they'd look and say, bastard. And it just had... And again, kids wouldn't understand. They go, so what? Mm. Nowadays. But it was a huge, huge thing then. So they replaced it with illegitimate. So she designed a short birth cert, which we still use.
Yeah, the short
Which just has your name, where you were born, nothing about your parentage. Just your name, where you were born. And that's acceptable for anything except the passport.
Do you know what I find amazing about your mother, though? Like, she also created a lot of changes within the area of education. She
big time.
Really wanted to help children. And yet, of her 11 children, I don't think any of you went post-primary.
Two went to tech.
What? But was she... This sounds awful. Was she great out
was
of the
Was she negligent?
No, that's a... Would Was she not particularly great mother to most of her children?
I
don't mean that offensively.
No, I get exactly where you're coming from, because you would think... Thanks to her being in the convent. It was only through the nuns that she got a university degree. She couldn't have afforded to go to university. It was through the convent that she was able to go to university, and she had a degree. So she knew the value of education. Of all people, she knew the value. She was also doing a lot of legislative work on education.
So what happened with her own
She didn't
children?
Trust the education system. School is designed to train kids, not teach them. She said there was no learning, it was just training.
But
training.
Your case, you left school.
Yeah.
You didn't go to post-primary.
No.
And yet, what is your IQ? No, I'm asking you to boast.
156.
Yeah, which is the top what?
Top 2% worldwide.
Yeah, but it seems ludicrous that's your IQ.
Look at my sister. Look at my sister. My sister Fiona, one of the twins. Fiona left school 12, 13 years of age, which you could then. Got a job as a young waitress in Arnott's restaurant, and then emigrated at 16 to Toronto. She retired 10 years ago as assistant vice president of the Union Bank of Switzerland. My sister Maureen left school probably at 11. And even in school, didn't really perform that well. Maureen finished up owning 4 hairdressing salons in London and a little empire of her own. My sister Marta eventually went back to university and got a degree in English at 46 years of age. My sister Pat left school at 12, ended up as one of the secretaries of the Special Olympics, where she lives in California, worldwide. They all did extremely well.
In other words, their brains outed in the end.
Well, it's just that you can't... First of all, you won't keep a good thing down. That's number one. And number two... Don't confuse education with intelligence. My mother often said she knew the most educated fools. So she didn't trust the education system.
And she also, on top of the 11 children, though, to be fair to your mother, she adopted Phil then, a boy from Artane.
Yeah, yeah. Phil was a great addition to the family. My dad, as my dad said, Phil used to come out to us at weekends. And one weekend we were out, and we lived in Ballymun at the time, and they just had built a wall around the front of the houses that they were in. And he was walking along the wall, and the wall actually fell down.
How old did he be?
He must have been around 10 or 11. And he broke his leg, or broke his arm or something. My mum took him to the hospital, dad took him to the hospital, and he got put in a plaster, and he was very upset, and she took him back to the house, and instead of going back to our tent, she put him to bed. And she came downstairs, and my dad was talking about, they were chatting away, and my mum said to my dad, what do you think about keeping Phil? And my dad said, would he be noticed? Will he be noticed? In the crowd, will he even be noticed? So she rang the next day, she rang the brother.
In our town.
And said, Phil's not coming back. And he said, no, it doesn't work like that. He's coming back, all right. And if I have to, I'll take you to court. She said, well, great, take me to court. And I'll tell you what, while we're doing that, let's audit you. Because I have the power to do that. And I will audit you, and I will take every book you have, and I will look inside out, and I will... And they just backed off. And Phil was adopted and stayed with us. I'm raging he didn't go back, because I would have loved her to have bothered it.
Do you think your mum maybe had a suspicion of what was happening within our town?
That's why you were threatened with it. As a kid, you were threatened with our town. I'm telling you, you will go to our town. Why would that be a threat if it wasn't, if we didn't know
how horrible
it was and how bad it was? We use it as a threat. I'm not talking about abuses around that. I'm talking about the system that allowed people to take children off families and put them into Artane just to prop up the financial coffers of an organisation. That's blatantly horrible. And we knew it was going on.
You say, Jenny, you'd like to have met his mother.
Oh, I would have loved to have met his mother.
Mm. Why?
First of all, as I said, I think she's a fascinating woman, that all the things that she did. But on a personal level, she's the person I knew him best. And it would have been lovely to have her around. And we often talk about that, you know, different things we talk about. And he'd say, my mother would have loved that conversation, or my mother would be. Mm. And she would have been sitting there doing the crossword with us. She would have been.
And all doing of this, better than either of you.
Yeah, and all of this, like she would. Brennan is very close to my mum and dad, and he has a relationship with them where they knew the young me, and I'd love to have his mum around.
Yeah, who knew be able the young to know him, the young me,
if that makes sense.
She would also have loved Jenny. She would have really taken to Jenny big time. And the extraordinary thing, when my mum died, she lived with me. Right up till she died. And she died, she took Danny, who's now 27, Danny was 10 months old, she took him up for sleep, and he went for a nap, and he went to sleep, and she died. And that's on a beautiful day in May, sunny day. And all she ever asked me was, please, Brennan, the only thing I ask you was, let me die at home and let me die on a sunny day. I said, well, the home bit I can do something about, man, but sunny day, I'm going to have to bump you off in September or whatever. But it was a beautiful sunny day, so she got both of her wishes.
Was she happy at the end of her life?
She's tired, it was time. She was tired. She was knackered. She was just knackered.
She wasn't that old, though.
No, she was only 73, but she'd had six lifetimes, you know, within one life. And I didn't cry. I organised everything, phoned the family, got them all home from all over the world. We did a three-day session of a party. It was fantastic. Best funeral I was ever at. We laughed and we sang and danced, and then everybody went home and it was all done. And I never cried, because I always felt, well, I had nothing to cry about. I got the best of my mum. I don't, and nothing left unsaid. My mum absolutely knew I adored her. I told her every day, as she told me. So I didn't have anything unsaid. I didn't have any unfinished business, etc., etc. 20 years later, I'm sitting in a hotel in New York, me and Jen, and I'm going to do a book reading in Rocky O'Sullivan's in New York. You don't ask to read in Rocky O'Sullivan's. You get invited to read. I'm sitting in the hotel lobby in Fitzpatrick's. Jenny's just coming down, and I ordered a Coke. Actually, a couple of vodkas for you and me. Vodkas arrived. And just fleetingly through my mind passed Rocky O'Sullivan's Jesus Mad Love This. And I started to cry. And I couldn't even tell Jenny. When she walked in, I couldn't even tell her what was wrong with me. I just couldn't even speak. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And it took me 20 years. She would have loved this. She would have just loved this. She used to say to me, that I could be anything and do anything I wanted. And I did genuinely say to her one day, I said, I can't fly, man. No matter how, I can't fly. She said, yes, you can. You just put your arms out, wait for the wind, and work hard. And I promise you, son, someday you'll take off. And we did a gig in Newcastle where we had 5,500 people at the gig. And I swear to God, as I'm taking the bow, all that was going through my mind was, look, back, I'm flying.
Oh, that's...
It's cool.
Let's take a break.
Yes.
We'll take a break.
Miriam meets on RTE Radio 1. Follow the programme on Twitter at Miriam Meets.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with comedian, also known as Mrs. Brendan O'Carroll, and his wife, actress Jenny Gibney. We're going to take a piece of music. It's Shine by Take That, but it has a relevance, doesn't it, in relation to your big win recently at the BAFTAs for Mrs. Brown Boys.
Yeah, this is our moment, really, is kind of the sentiment of it. And it's so upbeat, and it's part of the success we're having at the moment. And it's all, we know this is the time for the show, and it's wonderful to recognise that and be enjoying it. And this song kind of keeps us going. It's more upbeat, isn't it?
Mm.
Okay, let's take the song, and then we'll talk about Mrs. Brown's voice. Shine, Take That. You're such a big star to me. Shine, Take That, which reminds you both of your great win at the BAFTAs recently with Mrs. Brown's Boys. Actually, somebody just said to me there that Gary Barlow's mother loves the show.
Yes, yeah, she's been to all the live shows.
It might have been to all the shows in Manchester. Lovely. And she brings her friends along and they're huge fans.
Why do you think it has been such a mega success? I mean, like, even at the moment in Australia, apparently it's getting the same massive audience it's got in the UK and here. Why do you think it is so successful, Brendan?
Honestly, Mary, I don't know. I just the truth to God, I don't know. I've got my theories, I've got my ideas. I think it's just timing. I think it has its time. We're in a recession, and at a time when recession, people get nostalgic. If you look at the adverts, you'll see a lot of them in black and white. They're running the old fairy ads again.
The old
what's successful
again,
on TV,
yeah.
Mad Men. Mad Men goes back to the 60s, 70s. You know, people get nostalgic when we get afraid.
But does it also show that humour is the same everywhere? The fact that Australian audiences is at the moment like it as much as, say, British or Irish audiences.
It's on in Slovakia. It's on in Romania.
Iceland.
It's
and
on
everyone
in
South Africa.
And a huge reaction. But you're right. What it is this. There's a particular trail of comedy. Some people have diverse comedy ideas, but there's a particular train that's common. And it's one of those ones like watching an elephant and the air's coming out of a bag, a shopping bag, and the oranges going all over the place. And we all go, now we'd help her pick up the oranges, but we all laugh. Or somebody walking along the road texting and walking into a pole, and we fall around the place. There's threads that are common to everybody. And I think Mrs. Brown's Boys probably has a bit of that. There's a little bit of, you know, electrocuting herself and setting herself on fire and all these things. You kind of go, visually, they're funny.
You're playing Mrs. Brown's daughter, don't you, Jenny? Yeah. What's it like playing your husband's daughter?
It's very funny. It's great fun, actually. We have great fun together with it. We really do.
We never kiss.
No. The only time, people often ask me about what's it like with being my mother on stage and that. The only time it's odd is when my own mother comes to see the show.
Yeah.
And I feel ganged up on when Mrs. Brown is on the stage with me and Mammy's sitting in the audience. I'm going, she knows these things that are being said.
So what are rehearsals like? As we said at the beginning, you're very into precision.
Rehearsals. There's that word. Brendan's idea now of rehearsal, because there's five plays now and we do them, you know, in different cycles. And we'll all go, no, we have to, Brendan, we haven't done this play in a long time. We really, really have to rehearse it. Now, at least at this stage, we all have they record the last night of any show that we do so we can play it back if we're doing it again. But we get maybe the first scene we get to read together.
Well, this way I go, okay.
No, hang on. And he goes, blah, blah, blah. You sit there, I sit there, and we all leave. What? Take the bow. What's the problem?
Mrs. Brown comes
not
in,
a rehearsal.
She sits down. And when you walk in, you sit over there. Blah,
but,
blah, blah.
But am
you
I
say,
supposed
she's
to be
blah,
sitting
blah,
there?
And then we leave.
If you're not sitting in the right place, I'll move you. Just get on with it.
So do you like to ad lib a lot?
Uh-huh.
I think any work should be organic and should grow.
We never do the same show two nights in a row. You do not know when you go out there and you do not know what he's going
not
to
do. Not exactly
at
the same, no.
No.
Not exactly the same.
He makes it his goal when he goes out on stage to actually make at least one of us fall apart laughing.
How many of your family are in it?
I've got my son, my daughter, my wife, my son-in-law, my daughter-in-law, my sister. And,
my brother-in-law.
Yeah. I'll tell you something now.
It's nearly all family.
Yeah, I was going to say that. That's a hard question because
there are
members of that cast and crew. Now, worked with me for 20 years. And
their family
would be more family than family. Mm. So, I mean, if somebody said to me how many of the family are involved, my answer, honestly, is no, they're all family. And it took us a long time to get this team of crew we have together. We went through a lot of people to end up with the crew we had. We didn't start out as family. I didn't intend to marry Jenny. So we weren't husband and wife when we started doing this. I didn't intend Fiona to fall in love with my producer. And then, so my producer would become my son-in-law. I didn't intend Fiona to be in the show. She was taking a year out of college after finishing DIT. And she was taking a year out. And I said, well, why don't you work with us for the year? And then she fell in love with the producer. I didn't intend Danny to be Buster. He came on as a runner on the show and did little bits here and there and there. And then grew into the actor. He always wanted to be an actor. And then made Buster his own. I didn't intend him to fall in love with one of the actresses, Amanda, and marry her. So it's not like I said, I would love to create a little family empire. It didn't happen like that.
What about bad language? Is it only Mrs. Brown who uses the F word?
Yeah.
And did you think about taking that out for different audiences, whether it's Australia?
No, because fundamentally, we're not a TV series. we're a touring show. And when it came to doing the TV series, I said, there's a couple of things I want. And Steve McCrum was just such a great producer. He's just brilliant. And I said, look, if we make a mistake, I want to leave it in because I'll play with it. And I said, I think it'll become one of the attractions of the show. And he said, oh, Brendan, I suggest that the sitcom format was invented for a reason. And I said, yeah, I know, but let's break it. And if it doesn't work, well, then we just go back on the road. But if it does, you'll be the producer that brought this to TV.
But it had to be a true reflection of what
of
we
the
do
show.
On the live
show. I didn't
want
people to see the TV series and then come to the live show going, oh my God,
I wasn't expecting this. You know.
So it had to be a true reflection of that. And he gave me a great answer. When he made the initial approach to me, I said to him, what about the language? And he said, what language? I said, Mrs. Brown's language. Well, he said, the way I look upon that is, first of all, she never says the F word to actually mean what it means. She says it as the rhythm of her speech, as the rhythm of her vernacular. So removing it from Mrs. Brown, I would deem to be kind of like taking a word out of every second line in Wordsworth's poetry and hoping that it still had the same rhythm.
And also, she wouldn't have any of her kids using it, Mrs. Brown.
Oh, no. She wouldn't have it in her house. No. Absolutely not. She wouldn't have any fucking bad language in the house.
Is it sweet when you get this level of success?
All that does for me, financially, is it allows us to help other people.
Yeah.
Honestly, God, I have no interest in accumulating money. I have no interest. My kids know there is no legacy. Get it while you can, guys, because when I'm gone, it will be gone. It'll be the only reason there's any money in the bank now is because it's coming in faster than even I can spend it. But otherwise, there will be nothing.
For ourselves,
there are too many people out there who we can help.
For myself
now.
And Brendan, the only thing that the success can buy is more time. Time off.
Yeah, but you are generous. Not everyone who's rich is generous.
Look, I swear to God, and I'm not spoofing you, I get more out of giving and out of helping people than they get out of it. I just love the idea, and that's the only thing you can do for us, is help us to help somebody else.
I know you're involved now with a charity as well. I know you do lots of different charities, but Annam Cara, that I know myself, because didn't you had a little boy, Brendan?
Yes.
He died when he was a baby.
Yeah, Brendan died when he was a baby, and it's funny. It's funny, it's a blow you never get over, even though you think, because you're young and you're fit and well and you can have more kids, that you would get over it. But I swear to God, it really is. Irish mammy thing, I think, of it's not about the kids that are there. It's about the one that emigrated. It's the one that's not there. And you never... It had a profound effect on me. But at the same time, I'm not sure Brendan had... In Brendan's condition, I'm not sure if I'd have been able to cope that young with all that went with his condition. And
what was his condition?
His spina bifida and hydrocephalus. And I was really frightened. I remember being really scared at the time and not knowing what the future held. And it was so not in my plan. My plan was white picket fence, swinging out the back and perfectly healthy children running around saying, Daddy, Daddy, you're the best thing in the whole world. And all of a sudden, this upset the entire plan. So I think that even at a very young age, it was a great lesson that life doesn't go to plan A. And right now, I think I'm on plan J. But
you were only, were you 20? You were very young though.
21 or 22, 21. I think, I remember. I was very young. I mean, he'd be
in the show probably.
Probably would be. he probably would be the show. But it was a very sobering moment for me. I wouldn't recommend it. There's other ways of learning that lesson. But it was a very sobering moment for me and to understand that, you know, maybe God just took that away from me. Probably was the right thing to do. I wouldn't have been able to cope. And there are people who are coping with it every day, and I look at them and they're not just coping with things like that every day, they're coping with it and laughing and smiling and telling me how much I'm doing for them. And my God, what they're doing for us, what they're doing without the carers in this country. Bankrupt. We'd be morally and financially bankrupt without those carers.
No, they're extraordinary people. To go to something very light, was it important for you to win that BAFTA? Because I know you don't care about critics, but for a long time, people like to slag Mrs. Brown's boys.
Yeah.
But for them to win that top prize in British comedy, it must matter.
We didn't get it last year.
Yeah, totally.
We were nominated last year.
And
we didn't get it. So when we were nominated again this year, and three nominations, including director, was fantastic. But again, believe it or not, this year I thought we had less chance because we had 8.3 million viewers. I thought the nomination was them tipping their hat to us and saying, look, we can't ignore you, so we're tipping a hat to you with a nomination. But there's no way Mrs. Brown's Boys is going to get the best sitcom. It's just not going to happen.
On the night of the BAFTAs, you lost your dress, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Let's just explain that. You mean before the show?
Before the show.
Yeah, because after the show, she lost her dress as well.
Oh, we want to hear that too.
They don't want to hear that.
Yeah, we do.
We were in, we just come back from America on Saturday morning, and we were flying out to London to the BAFTAs on Sunday. And myself and my sister, in our cases, was, I'm talking about from makeup, jewellery, dress, shoes, everything. And that's all. It was in separate case. We just had to pack it the next day to go to London, and our cases didn't arrive home. So we were 24 hours to go into the BAFTAs with nothing.
And she had a second choice dress that was wrong. So she went down to choice number three, which was...
A dress I bought in Debenhams with my mum about 10 years ago.
Oh, 10 years ago.
What happened was myself and my sister said, we can either make this into the biggest drama of our lives, that, oh my God, the BAFTAs, we haven't got our BAFTA dresses, or we can just wear something and go to it. And if we win tomorrow night, who cares what we're wearing?
I think it was one of the journalists asked me, I think it was from the Irish World newspaper in London, said, so who are you guys wearing? And I said, well, I'm wearing whoever it was. And I said, and Jenny's wearing, I made up a name, Cuckoo Kaka, you know, Japanese. Oh, right. And is there any reason for the specific choice of colour? I said, well, I'm wearing the green, which is Kelly Green, the Irish green. And Jenny is wearing the state blue, St. Patrick blue, which is the state blue. And they ran with it. They ran with that. I didn't say that Jenny's wearing the dress she got in Debenhams 10 years ago, because her other ones didn't arrive.
It looked fantastic. I mean, but when you went up to get the award, when you stood on the stage, what went through your minds?
It was a long walk.
It was.
And what went through my mind was the nights that I trudged through the snow at 2 a.m. with a can, looking to try and get diesel because the van ran out of diesel. Arriving at gigs with 6 people there because the venue forgot to put up posters. The not getting paid at gigs. The heartache of Sparrow and thinking that you'd never walk again. And all of those things went through my mind, and just as I walked up those steps, I could see this. I could see the BAFTA in his hand, and Darrow Brin behind, beaming with a smile. And it was all worth it.
Yeah, it was. It was such a joyful feeling there.
It was all worth it.
It was amazing. It was such joy from everybody there.
We weren't expecting it.
A lot of people even said it to us that night. Said, "My God, you guys really looked like you were having fun." And we're going, "Well, we were. We really were." It was.
And you know what we did? Because we'd been there the previous year, and there was an after party, and it was boring as hell. And this time what we did was, the hotel we stayed in, when they heard we won them, the BAFTA, called and said, we've set aside a bar for you guys. So we all went back
and got into our jammies.
Got into our pyjamas up in our room.
And came down to the bar.
And we sat at the bar till the early hours of the morning in our pyjamas and the BAFTAs and just had a sing song.
It was great. Everybody got to kick off the high heels, get out of the, you know, the dresses and just.
Into our jammies, our shorts and t-shirt or whatever. And we all came, got out of the stiff. And we came down and we put the four, we got 4 BAFTAs. Because Stephen, Ben, Marty and myself get one. The producer, director, and the 2 producers and the director. And me, and we had the 4 BAFTAs there, and we go, another drink from BAFTA, please.
Where's your BAFTA? Where's your BAFTA on IFTA now?
Wherever I am. Honest to good God.
Do you bring them?
Doesn't leave home without them.
I brought them to the, I didn't bring them today, no, sorry. I had them on the windowsill at home in Hollystown today. I brassed them. I've been brassing them virtually every day. Jenny said it's a bit anal. I said, no, it's not. Because I keep thinking, how many people get to go up in the morning and rub a bit of brass on a BAFTA? Not too many, so I'm going to do it. Let me just make this very clear. I'm not just as proud of the IFTA as I am of the BAFTA. I'm more proud of the IFTA than I am the BAFTA. Because there is this phenomenon of not being recognised in your hometown. Yeah. And I don't mean that an Irish phenomenon. It's the same in America. Yeah. It's the same in... To come home and take an IFTA was more spectacular than the BAFTA. It was just that nod of somebody saying, well done.
That's what I'm proudest of, is you look at any popular comedies and watch the credits at the end. It's a team of writers. Mm. This is one writer.
Yeah.
Watch the credits at the end of this, and every week it says,
he's also the
by
main
Brendan
actor.
O'Carroll.
Yeah.
And it, as well as starring in it, but he created it, and it's one name. And that's the proudest credit that comes up is written by Brendan O'Carroll.
Mm. Thank you, love.
Ah, she loves you.
I guess she has to.
I'd say so.
Well, look, we're going to end now. I'm delighted for you both and for your success, Brendan.
Thanks,
it's very
much,
well deserved. We're going to end on a Louis Armstrong song.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you like this, both of you?
We have all the time in the world.
At the time, coming up to getting married, I wanted to try and get married where we were both in our 40s. I was 49, Jenny was 40. And I was just coming up to 50. I was a month away from being 50. And I wanted to get married before I was 50. And we sometimes thought about, you know, God Almighty, how long it's taken for us to meet each other. And then we realised, you know what,
we've all the time in the world.
And this is the song that we played, the very first song at a wedding and the very first song we danced to as a husband and wife. And we really have. We've all the time in the world.
Yeah, we still do.
Mm. Well, look, thanks a million. Safe journey back to Florida.
Yes, we're heading away.
And thank you very much for
thank
being
you,
with
Miriam.
Us. And congrats once again.
Thank
my thanks
so
and sound today to Noel Roberts, to my producer, Yeti Redmond. Thank you all very much for listening at home. We're here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we go out listening to Louis Armstrong's We've Got All the Time in the World.